2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 171, Fundamentalist Mormons in the News, Part 2. A panel discussion featuring Bill Morrison, David Zolman, Ann Wild, Sidney Anderson, Shane Whelan, and Linda Kelch.
Good afternoon. I guess we will get started with the 4:45 p.m. session, Fundamentalist Mormons in the News, Part 2. My name is Bill Morrison. We have a really distinguished panel here today, and I'll talk about them in just a second. But I wanted to have just say very few words, because I'm going to be the moderator for the panel, and it's really not something you guys want to listen to. In particular, since we've got all of these other nice folks on the panel who have much more interesting things to say. Let me just say this. Do I have a heritage of polygamy? Yes, I do. Can you hear back there?
Not very well.
How about that? A little bit more? How about that? Is that better? Okay. I was saying, do I have a heritage in polygamy? And my answer is yes, I do. In fact, I'm happy to say that my great-great-great-great-great, et cetera, granduncle was with Joseph Smith in Washington, D.C., as an attorney then, and I'm an attorney now. How odd that is. That hasn't changed much. When President Buchanan told Joseph Smith that your cause is just, but I can do nothing for you. So I come by it naturally, and from that point until Short Creek, when my aunt, and I was 5 years old, and I remember, and I wasn't at Short Creek, except that my family drove there to visit my aunt, and we were able to witness to some degree the deprivations on these poor people, and we saw the police officers that were there, and everybody recalls that if you have any familiarity with what happened at Colorado City, Arizona in 1952, where the police agencies swooped down and took all these women and children, and a couple of husbands as well, not very many. It was the demise of the governor's career after that happened, a horrible event. My aunt Margie, who I remember quite well, and she's alive today, had a little 10-year-old daughter who was ill, and they bused them to Kingston, Arizona. She was ill. They refused to give any medication because they were fearful that this giant conspiracy might erupt in which all of the police force may be pushed back in some fashion. And that little girl died because she didn't have any medical attention. And of course, my Aunt Marge has never forgotten that. I haven't either. And even as a 5-year-old, it's kind of etched in my memories some of the things that they had to go through. It hasn't changed much up to now with Tom Green and the difficulties that he sees himself in. I met Tom about a year before he was actually charged, and Tom was a lit fuse, and everybody knew what was going to happen, including Tom. At that time, he wanted to hire me as an attorney, but Dave Levitt, the Juab County prosecutor, was putting a lot of pressure on his wives as well. And bless their heart, we met together and we talked, and I'm not privy to say what our discussions related to, except to say that when we were called in before Mr. Levitt, and they were deposed, pre-filing of any criminal actions, every single one of those women, including an ex-wife, refused to testify against their husband, Tom Green. They faced prison sentences, and Mr. Levitt was very clear on that. He didn't beat around the bush. He said, you will testify, or we're going to haul you into court, and we'll hold you in contempt, and you can go to jail until you feel like testifying. Even in the face of that, they would not testify against their husband. What a true heritage that is. Let me talk about the panel. We've got some really interesting people. I'll start with Ann Wild, and I'd like to welcome Ogden, because I know he's here in spirit, if not in person. Ogden was one of my good friends. I want to say best friend, because there were so many best friends of Ogden's. Everybody was, truly. Because that's how he treated you. Ann was born and raised in the LDS Church. Comes from generations of strong pioneer ancestors. She graduated from BYU, and maybe we can't hold that against you, those of us who graduated from the U. Married in the Los Angeles Temple, during that 9-year marriage, she and her husband learned about many changes that she was concerned about that occurred in the LDS Church. And she chose to accept the original gospel as taught in the 19th century rather than the modified version of the 20th and 21st centuries. Her second marriage to Ogden Kraut was a long-term plural one, during which time she and her husband Ogden have written 65 books. That's just incredible to me. Those of us who have never written any, and the people on the panel who have, I readily applaud them. 65 books, and I've read those, and I can't say enough positive things about the books. And they're all on fundamentalist gospel principles. In December of 2000, together with two other plural wives, she co-authored a book entitled Voices in Harmony, Contemporary Women Celebrate Plural Marriage, which is a compilation of a number of essays from 100 women who have lived, now live, or would like to live plural marriage as an eternal principle. I can say the book's available at Benchmark, so I guess we can put a plug in because that's where Ann works. As a result of this book and Ogden Kraut's recent death, Ann, who has had 100 media interviews, and we welcome her to the panel. Sitting next to Ann is Shane LeGrand Whelan. And you know he's got to be a Mormon if his middle name is LeGrand, right? He wrote this book, Plural Marriage, A Sacred Heritage, A Promise for Tomorrow. And we've all driven past that sign on 9th South and State Street. I don't know how that still has been allowed, even with the Second Amendment, to continue. And it surprises me every day that it's up. But more power to Mr. Whelan. It's an excellent book. And of all things, I flip through here, and there's my great-great-great aunt who was in here, or grandmother, rather, I'm sorry, Margaret Forkshire Cruikshank Morrison. So you did quite a thorough book to include some of my own relatives. Thanks. Look forward to hearing what he has to say on the panel. And on the other side of Ann Wild, Representative Dave Zolman, another book writer. This book that I hold in my hand, and I was able to get one of the few copies that he's got, and I would suggest you get them while they're available. I didn't know one was available. Mary Luella Abbott Levitt, of all things, ancestry of our archenemy, Dave Levitt. And I can say that, and I'll talk about Dave. I like Dave. He and I are friends. And we've debated each other. In fact, Sydney on the panel is a part of that process. This book is very extensive, and it's well written as always. I can't advocate it enough and suggest that you pick it up while it's still available. These things have a habit of going out of print, and you'll never get one. And it's got some extremely interesting comments, and maybe Dave will allude to those comments from Mr. Levitt's ancestor or grandmother about plural marriage, about polygamy, and about how she hoped and prayed. Well, I won't say that because that would steal his thunder, but ask him about it. If he doesn't mention it, you better ask him, because I will, about what Mr. Levitt's own grandmother had to say about, would you, with the efficacy of polygamy. And I want to say this, too. You're looking at one of the true heroes of our era. It is so far and few times that happen where people actually stand up for their principles and they have to sacrifice because of those. Dave was a very well-respected representative. And he lost that position. He was voted out. And he was voted out because of his advocacy, and he's not a polygamist, of plural marriage, something extremely unpopular. He had the courage to stand up for that which was unpopular, and it certainly resulted in his political demise, the end of his political career, something which he was very adept at. Linda Kelch, sitting next to Representative Zolman. Linda is a very strong advocate of the positive side of plural marriage. And she has a breadth of experience that few of us have. And I hope that there's a lot of questions and things that you can ask her on a personal basis, because she will give you the answer. Sitting next to Linda is Sidney Armstrong, my comrade in arms. We were compatriots debating David Levitt and the head of the Tapestry of Polygamy at Weber State College a few months back. And, wow, what a live wire. Holy smokes. You'll see. And you'll see, because she brings her placards. She'll talk about them. And we may have to pull her back a little bit, because otherwise it will be an hour and a half of Sydney's placards and talking about those things. And I'm just teasing. Because We only have 7 to 8 minutes per person. So we have a time limitation here, and I've already gone beyond my 7 or 8 minutes, and I'm going to start, and it's going to be run in this order, if you would, and everybody has the opportunity to ask questions, and I'd certainly encourage that. The first speaker will be Ann Wild, and I'd ask the speakers to come up here and use the podium so that everybody can see you. The second speaker will be Shane Whelan. The third speaker will be Sydney Armstrong. The fourth speaker will be Linda Kelch. And the fifth speaker will be Dave Zolman. Okay. We'll start. Ann.
As I was preparing some remarks to give for this paper, I just realized that I can say for the first time and probably the last time that I have lived half my life in plural marriage. Never again will I be able to say that it was equally half outside and equally half inside. I can honestly say that those last 33 years, of course that gives away my age, but the last 33 years have been by far the happiest. I can't compare them even to the first 33 years, and I thought I was raised with a silver spoon in my mouth. But there's a feeling that comes with living a principle that you feel like you're supposed to live for religious reasons that you cannot get in any other way. For many years, I was perfectly content to let Ogden take the limelight, and I'd still be content to do that. But I was more than glad to just stay in the background and let him take all the media interviews. In fact, whenever they came to our home, I would say, "Don't quote me. You know, he's the authority, just quote him." However, about a little over two years ago, two wonderful women and myself, decided with a little help from the outside that we were supposed to write a book on contemporary plural marriage. And what a journey that has been. The book that we wrote, as Bill has mentioned, was Voices in Harmony, Contemporary Women Celebrate Plural Marriage. Without going into detail, the inspiration from this book truly came from outside the three of us. We felt like we were the ones, for various reasons, that were supposed to write a book like this. We contacted about 700 women that we knew, or women that, from friends of women that we knew, that had lived or were now living plural marriage. We felt like we wanted to give them an opportunity to voice their experiences. And so along the way, we were encouraged, even prodded, we felt like, from an outside source. As we started to work on this book, and this is what has resulted in our connection with the media, and that's why I'm mentioning it now, there were four premises that we wanted to write the book upon. The first one is to present a positive voice for plural marriage, because for years all we've heard are the negative impressions, the people that get in trouble with the law, the squeaky wheels, so to speak. So we wanted to show that there was a positive side of this principle. Then we wanted to demonstrate that a significant number of adult women have freely chosen to accept this lifestyle and can live it happily. The third, to help dispel false stereotypes. And I'm sure you're probably aware of the typical stereotypes that women are under the thumb of a very controlling husband, they're married at a young age, they don't have education, they live on welfare. These things, unfortunately, are true in a number of cases, but I'd say by far the minority. So we wanted to show that this was not necessarily true in the majority of cases. And then we wanted to allow plural wives to speak for themselves. We had to do this anonymously, or we wouldn't have had anybody contribute. Because of the climate in the community, not only in Salt Lake but in Utah, if anyone were to speak up and give their name, their jobs, their family, their reputation would be in jeopardy. So we provided this opportunity for them as anonymous contributors. So after laboring for about 9 months, we delivered our baby in December of 2000. And shortly before that, the birth announcement was made by Representative David Zolman. And we appeared before the Republican caucus up at the Capitol building. And this unique event was reported by Greg Burton in the Salt Lake Tribune. And he says, quote, And then Zolman asked the three authors to stand. It was a strange moment. Three women, two of them plural wives, rising in the midst of Utah's Republican leadership, a group with many members whose family trees have polygamous branches. And I cannot tell you the feeling the three of us had. And we've never made a claim to a thing. And to stand up in front of men who heretofore had really represented the opposition, and we stood being recognized by name in front of those people who would just love to see us punished, persecuted, go to jail for our lifestyle. So when he says it was a strange moment, indeed it was. Standing there before such a dignified body of legislators was a surreal experience. It was a huge step for the three of us who were there representing and defending hundreds, even thousands, of contemporary plural wives who have freely chosen this lifestyle because of their strong religious convictions. And I can't emphasize that enough. We are not living this for just because we think it's a convenient lifestyle, just because we want to have a woman in the house that we're good friends with, and hey, this is great, the husband can go do what he wants and we can do what we want. In the cases that I'm familiar with, we are doing it because it's a strong religious conviction. It's an eternal principle. Well, after our book came out, we began receiving many favorable and appreciative reports from the readers of our book. To quote a couple of them, "At no time in my life have I been so powerfully moved by the spirit of another's testimonies as I have by those women that have shared their feelings through your book." And the second one, "I ran the gamut of my emotions in reading this work, from the deepest despair at the injustices of men to great joy at the touching testimonies of spiritual women who wish to serve the Lord." And we received many such comments, and it really made us feel like, indeed, this was a mission that we were supposed to accomplish. After our introduction at the Capitol, a long series of media interviews ensued for the three of us. In a subsequent Tribune article, it stated, "This month's release of Voices in Harmony could be a stepping stone for a political movement by Utah's roughly 30,000 men, women, and children who live in polygamous households." And this proved to be true. 2 months later, the three of us, plus a handful of plural wives, successfully lobbied for 2 days at the Utah State Capitol against the anti-polygamy Senate Bill No. 146. And nearly 100 defenders of plural marriage attended the Judicial Committee hearing, resulting in a softening of the wording of that bill. The Tribune again picked up a report of that event and said, "Nearly 100 polygamists and their supporters backed a Capitol Hill hearing on an anti-polygamy bill Tuesday, a rare public assembly of plural families." And then quoting from a member of the Judiciary Committee, he said, "I've never seen this many people come to one of our hearings on any subject." So we felt like we had really been a part of a history-making event. That afternoon, Mary Batchelor debated with Ron Allen, the author of this bill, number 146, before a meeting of the Women's State Legislative Council, and represented our side extremely well. A rash of letters to the editor followed in both the local papers, Salt Lake and in Provo, and numerous local radio and television personnel called the three of us. And we had interviews with all kinds of media for the next 18 months. Even till today, practically, we're still being interviewed occasionally. Some of the national media that interviewed us were the New York Times, Newsweek, CNN, the New Yorker Magazine, and the Washington Times. And if you don't think it's funny to see your name in print in the New York Times with a picture, in fact, I have to just tell you one little incident. I have a high school friend, and I've kept in touch with her through the years. She's not even LDS, and she's a school teacher down in California, and didn't know about my lifestyle, and she just happened to pick up a New York Times while she was waiting in somebody's office, and comes to find out here's a picture of Ann Wild, her longtime friend. So she calls and says, "Is this the Ann Wild I've known and loved for all these years, and she's been a plural wife, and I didn't even know it?" So, you know, it was really amazing how word gets around, and it's funny for me even now to be able to stand up here and admit that indeed I am a plural wife, because I could never do that for years. As the dates began or drew near for the 2002 Olympics, reporters from foreign countries began calling. And before the two-week sporting spectacular was over, we had spoken with media representatives from 12 different foreign countries. I won't list them, but they're the usual England, France, Canada, so forth. We found ourselves, however, in these interviews defending the state of Utah and the LDS Church along with the lifestyle of plural marriage. We were given the chance to separate the two, to show that Utah is an up-and-coming state, that is a wonderful place to live, that the LDS Church no longer practices plural marriage, that we do that as a separate belief of our own, separate from the church, so that it gave more credence to the LDS Church in their eyes because they thought the LDS Church might still promote plural marriage in some way. So we were defending, I think, everybody as best as we could. It was interesting for the three of us to observe the skeptical attitudes of nearly all the reporters as they entered our homes to begin the interviews. Most of them didn't know what to expect as they came in to interview plural wives. But as they left, they all commented how much more they understood the principle. They had an element of respect for the people that lived it. And in some cases, they even gave us a friendly hug as they went out the door. To us, that was a real accomplishment because we knew they would go out to their various media places and spread the word, so to speak. The three of us have participated in panels for MHA, Sunstone, Weber State, and are grateful for the numerous opportunities we've had to try and raise the level of understanding of both the principle and plural marriage, the principle of plural marriage, and of most of the people involved in it. I realize it's difficult for most Mormons to understand why fundamentalist Mormons are so committed to such a lifestyle. Ogden Kraut committed as a member of this panel last year, quote, "Why then do fundamentalist polygamists keep pursuing a lifestyle that is so bitterly opposed by both church and state?" And he answers, "It's because they believe it is not only a constitutional right, but also an eternal law with eternal blessings." Ogden's death less than a month ago on July 17th was also in the news. Both local papers had articles in addition to the obituaries, and radio and television stations commented on his passing. For several years, he had been very vocal in defense of his fundamentalist beliefs and was considered an expert authority by many media reporters. The Deseret News stated that Ogden, quote, "often provided expert and temperate opinion when polygamist issues rose to public attention." And in closing, I'd like to just very briefly tell, as a tribute to him, some of the qualities that he had that were an example to me and to others. He was a prolific author. In 33 years, he wrote and or compiled 65 books on the fullness of the gospel. His research and works are recognized and appreciated by members of all fundamentalist Mormon groups, independent fundamentalists, as well as members of the LDS Church. As Samuel W. Taylor said in 1988, when Ogden had written only 33 books, Ogden could very well be the most prolific living Mormon author. And he's now written practically twice that many before he died. He was a recognized peacemaker, and he was the one that was called during the Singer Swap siege and acted as a mediator because he was respected by both sides. He was a polygamous patriarch. He believed and practiced what he taught, and yet he gave his children freedom to choose for themselves what route they wanted to go. Six of his eight birth children are still active members of the church. He was a loyal friend. People from all over the world came to meet Ogden and to visit with him, and they'd come at all hours of the day and night. No matter what he was doing, he would drop it and visit with them, and that's why when Bill said everybody thought they were Ogden's best friend because he treated them that way. He took time for them. He was interested in them. He had a beautiful way of explaining the gospel, which leads me to the next point. He was an excellent teacher. He went on a mission without purse or script, and he had a way of teaching the gospel to both non-members and members alike, from the very most elementary doctrines of the gospel to the most complex. And in closing, in the list, he was indeed a Joseph Smith Mormon. That pretty well sums up his description of himself and my description of him, and that's what we will have engraved on his grave marker. It's truly been an honor and a blessing for me to learn, work, travel, and serve at his side for 33 years, and I hope this is just the beginning of eternity for us. Thank you.
Okay, how come I didn't get any applause? Thanks. Nah. Not the same. Anyway, I see the two other authors, and I'm going to embarrass them a little bit and ask them to stand, the Voices in Harmony. So Mary Batchelor and Mary Ann Watson, please stand, would you? This is the book. This is the book that Ann was alluding to. Shane Whelan.
It's really a pleasure to be here and an honor, especially be here with these people. Dave and Ann, I've had a chance to get to know very well and consider them good friends. Before I go on any further, though, I do need to give some credit here where credit is due. And although I am the author of more than one, there is another co-author, if you want to call her a co-author, and I'm going to embarrass her, and she's going to hate me for this, but Rhonda, raise your hand. This is my dear wife who has put in as much time or more into the research and study in this book and also was responsible for compiling all the stories. So, now you're going to really get me in trouble for that. So, it was suggested that I talk about the phenomenon of more than one, and besides that being a very difficult word for me to say, it is not something that I pictured my book to be as a phenomenon. The book that was written is a polygamy book, and I suppose that the fact that it was written by two mainstream Mormons, very common people, that in itself is a phenomenon. I'm not sure how many of you know, but more than one actually came from the research that initially Rhonda and I had started involving her great-grandparents, who were polygamous actually on both sides in Canada, members of the church, back in the early church. And as we read their stories in journals, we found out that there was really another side to polygamy, one that was not told in the media. And we had talked about it and prayed about it and felt very strongly that we needed to write this book. And we felt then and still believe now that it is a story that needs to be told. The research, writing, and editing of the book was a monumental task. Along with the printing of the book, took almost 2 years, which I understand now is really not that long, but it seemed forever to us. Being our first book and not really knowing how deep the water was, we jumped in with both feet. We soon realized that we were way over our head in a very, very controversial subject. We have very strong feelings about this book, and I can tell you here with much conviction and certainty that this book has a very important purpose. We know that because not only have we seen many miracles in the writing and the publishing of the book take place, but there also has been a great deal of adversity that has been in our life since we started this book almost on a day-to-day basis. And if that's any measure of what the book is about, then I would say it's a great book. We started here with the book and the production of it, as I mentioned, 2 years ago. The reactions of it to when it came out, which was in November of last year, have been good and bad. We actually saw quite a division. People were either for or against the book. There weren't too many in the middle. I pulled out just three emails, of some of the reactions that we get, and these are things that come to us day to day over the website. JM, that's who this is from here, says, "I am curious to read your book, but I feel strongly that I don't want to support your abhorrent ideas and therefore do not want to submit any money to this cause. May your book and faulty opinions fail miserably." And then, of course, we have the middle-of-the-road one here. It says, "I saw your bio on the website and you have listed one wife. Do you have any others? Do you intend to marry any more? Please let me know very soon." I don't know whether that was a man or a woman. I'm not sure there. The last one here that I want to read you is something that was very positive and uplifting for us. And it says, he says, "What a book. He says, I can't wait to get a copy. My wife is buying me one as a gift. If it is half as good as the excerpts, it will be worth twice the price. I believe section 132 of the DNC is very plainly a revelation on plural marriage. But few at church discuss it with me. P.S. The Johnsons will be praying for you and your family." And that really is the dilemma we often see with this book. There are so many members of the church that have a great interest in plural marriage, but they're afraid to go out there and find it. When we started, actually, let me just bring one other thing here. The Chris Smith, I don't know if you're familiar with him, he's a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. I think he put into a very good picture. He says, more than one has become the Victoria's Secret catalog that gets stashed in the clothes hamper when the home teachers come by. That really is the truth. When we start promoting the book, we gave a lot of promotional copies out, and we had asked our friends, what do you think about the book? And the most common answer is, well, we need another copy. And I said, well, why do you need a copy? And they said, well, we gave it to our friend, and they gave it to somebody else, and nobody really knows where it went to. And we begin to find out that friends begin to pass it to friends, and that really no one was going out there and buying the book because they were afraid to. And that's very unfortunate. We decided, well, you know, there's something wrong here. It created a very difficult marketing problem. We decided that before people could feel good about reading the book or buying it, they had to feel good about plural marriage. And so we decided that we'd start a campaign, and it started with our billboards, focusing on changing the attitude towards polygamy rather than selling the book. I believe it has been very successful. It has brought light to a darkened subject, and at the very least, it has brought a lot of attention to it. A lot of people would hope would go away and be forgotten. And that really is the phenomenon of More Than One. It's a book that is needed and wanted by members of the church. And it's also replacing the Victoria's Secret catalog in Elias Homes. Thank you.
Sidney Armstrong, rector of Women's Religious Liberties Union.
Okay, if I speak fast, it's not my fault, but I've got to live down some kind of reputation, I guess. Who am I? Publicly, I cannot validate the truthfulness of the statement that I am a plural wife. Quoted from Donald and H. Oaks, I think, used this. I cannot validate the truthfulness of that statement. The first two words appear are freedom versus oppression. And you've heard of fear, and you've heard of people even fearing going into a bookstore to buy a book. And this fear is very real and is still very alive. This fear has been brought into my home very directly by illegal wiretaps and bugs that have been detected by electronic specialists. They have broken into my home, and they have placed those wiretaps and bugs more than once, and continue to do so. It is not something that is going to go away. It hasn't in the 150 years of the church, because as Anne so eloquently stated, it is a principle of faith, and we are dedicated to our principles of faith. We do not enforce them on other people, nor do we expect all people to believe as we believe. But we do insist upon our right and our freedom to choose this lifestyle if we do so. All of the inherent evils of polygamy, all of the stereotypes, I'm sorry, monogamy has got us beat hands down. The jails are full of monogamous child abusers, welfare abusers, spouse abusers, blah-de-de-blah-de-de-blah. Okay.
No.
You hope. Duct tape did not work. If you want to talk about how to subjugate a minority, which is exactly what we are, a minority.
What?
Sydney Anderson. You do so by doing exactly what they have done to the polygamous community. First off, you make them criminals by their creed. Poor wives have to live in fear. They have to live in hiding. You create and maintain laws that selectively prosecute that particular minority. That's represented down through the history of time, no matter what minority you were belonging to, be it black, Jew, Catholic, whatever. You unjustly imprison, which has been proven and done. You create public prejudice and hysteria, which has effectively been done because there are bad apples in every barrel. No one's arguing that point. You isolate from the mainstream. You keep people living out in southern deserts and in Arizona, and you force them to live away from economic development, and you make sure that they know they're not welcome to be your next-door neighbors. Deprive the minority of economic advantages, and you deny them educational opportunities also. All of these aspects are what have been perpetrated against all minorities, and they are being perpetrated against probably the last minority to stand in this nation, and that is of those of plural wives who continue to live and believe in this principle. There are many precedent laws. The Morrell Act and Reynolds criminalized plural marriage, and why? It was to protect. It was done so to protect moral sensibilities, and there's no rational basis for this restriction. Cole versus Smith, the Supreme Court found the irrevocable clause could not be enforced due to equal footing standing. This is referring to the clause in the Utah State Constitution that says it will ever prohibit polygamy. That's fine, you can prohibit polygamy, but you cannot deny people their civil right to live their religion. And that does not mean just have a belief that they cannot act upon. Our civil rights ensure that we are able to act upon those religious beliefs. Oh, and this state could easily remove that prohibition because of that clause. Griswold versus Connecticut, the court found specific guarantees in the Bill of Rights that create the zone of privacy. The government has absolutely no right to have a wiretap bug in my bedroom. None. Romer versus Evans, Colorado's Amendment Second, Colorado's Second Amendment violated the Constitution. It singled out homosexuals for unfavorable treatment, and it was a bill born of animosity. The bills against polygamy and plural lifestyles is the same thing. It singles us out, and it's born of animosity. It is wonderful to see communities and to see an awakening to a principle that although you do not have to live, you don't even have to believe in, but the willingness of individuals such as yourself to fight for our rights and our freedom to do so, if we so choose. There are a number of pamphlets over there on the table. A couple other books that haven't been mentioned you might want to pick up. Those are my copies, so don't run away with them. And I appreciate your time this evening. Thank you.
You did good, Sydney. All right, our next speaker is Linda Kelch. Linda, I neglected to mention, was at the Capitol last year in an imbroglio with Ron Allen. And I remember seeing her on the news, and she was quite firm. I was very impressed. Linda Kelch.
My first experience with the media was in the 50s when my father was arrested for plural marriage. And this experience was very, it impacted me in a very negative way. I was very proud of my father for going to prison to pay for my birthright so that I didn't have to be called a bastard. But I was also told that if I spoke out, I might bring danger to my family, that we might be taken away from our parents. And I've lived in that fear up until this past year when Mary invited me to lobby with her. And I realized that this fear was holding me back and I needed to move through it. So I've spent the last year and a half speaking out and advocating for women and children of plural marriage who still live in fear of speaking out. I found this article in a magazine about the well-being of families. I just thought I'd start out with this. It says, people and children are wounded by non-acceptance by their peers and society. In a recent news report, David Levitt is quoted saying the Green Wives are, quote, victims of polygamy, unquote, indicating they don't know any better. In my experience as a child of plural marriage and attending public school, I saw what was outside of my family and my culture. As a grown woman having chosen plural marriage, I see far more women and children in polygyny who are victims of the effects of unjust laws than there ever were of domestic abuse or so-called forced marriages. In fact, the laws against plural marriage tend to keep women silent who might otherwise report domestic abuse or ask for badly needed aid for her children because of the threat to her family or the possible attack on her children. I personally am grateful for the issue surrounding polygyny to have surfaced again in a time when society seems to be much more tolerant of diverse lifestyles, more sensitive to human relationships, and more conscious of human needs outside of their own limited experience, community, or religious belief. No longer can this issue be hidden from view or ignored. It seems that the opportunity has come for each of us to take responsibility for our own beliefs and choices and respect one another's differences. I've witnessed a definite difference in the attitude of the media in the last year, for the most part. They seem to be moving away from the characteristic propaganda similar to that used through the media on the Mormon pioneers by the United States in the 19th century, and again on the Jews of Nazi Germany in the 20th century, because a culture was a little different than the mainstream. Propaganda designed to stir up the public so that the powers that be could do their dirty deeds with the support of the general populace, with little or no understanding of the magnitude of human suffering as a result. Today's press seems to be developing a human heart more willing to report both sides of the issue and educate the public. And the public seems to be more open-minded and willing to look at the other side of the coin. I'm grateful to the co-authors of The Voices in Harmony for their courage in going public with the inside story from many who have actually experienced the positive aspects of plural marriage. I'm grateful to Professors Altman and Gannott for their professional, in-depth study. As far as I know, the first one that's been done to that extent. Study of this culture in their book, Polygamous Families in Contemporary Society. These great works, among others, have accomplished a great deal in educating the public about this grossly misunderstood culture. I'm grateful to the Green family for their courage in exposing themselves to the public criticism, ire, discrimination, and prosecution, with the hope that their solidarity as a family unit and the deep conviction of their religious beliefs would show the world an alternative to the painful serial monogamy and general breakdown of the family unit created by the divorce epidemic. They have succeeded in bringing out an example of the positive and negative issues of polygyny that are ready to be examined by today's society. Now that those issues are out in the open and both sides of the story are being told, my hope is that an objective examination will continue on all levels. Namely, an honest examination by those inside the culture to see what isn't working, as well as those outside the culture to see what is working. An objective look at the truth behind all unjust laws which have been forced upon consenting adults within a marriage relation to satisfy political agendas. My hope as an advocate for women and children of the polygamous culture is that the necessity and value of decriminalizing all laws pertaining to plural marriage will be recognized and acted upon by the legislature. The necessity being the need to create enough safety for women and children to get the assistance and protection they need without their beliefs being disrespected or attacked. The polygynous culture as a whole feels the need to protect their beliefs through silence, and in fact has been threatened through the media with prosecution if they dare participate in free speech. My hope is that education of the public concerning this lifestyle will continue with an open dialogue of understanding, and not only tolerance, but respect for choices made by consenting adults where there is no victim. The value being an alternative choice available for women who might otherwise be forced into a lifestyle that doesn't serve their needs as a woman. Plural marriage has been a precious gift to me as a child and as a woman. I acknowledge and appreciate all you people who participate in the Sunstone Symposium, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak. And I say these things with all due respect for any opposing views, and in the name of Jesus Christ.
Representative David Zolman.
Well, easy. I'm very pleased to be here and hear these marvelous pilgrims and pioneers speak before me. My pioneering has come to a screeching political halt. As 6 weeks ago, I ran and by one vote got out of convention against an incumbent and then suffered the most humiliating defeat in my political life. And that's something, because when I started this in 1996, I ran for mayor in a group of 11 who were running for mayor for our little Taylorsville town for the first time. And out of nowhere, I was complete unknown, I went from 11th place, the Z, to second, and lost only to the mayor, who lasted only 2 years. I beat a sitting state senator and some other things. So that the next year, when the seat to the House came open, I was unopposed. So I go from that extreme of being completely unopposed and only opposed the second time by a Libertarian candidate, to then the third time being opposed by an Arkansas Democrat. Let's remember what happened to us because of Arkansas. And she has, with this little whisper campaign, said he'll legalize polygamy and he'll fire all the teachers. Don't vote for that guy. She has become the equivalent of a political cipher in the snow on the hill. You've never heard from her. If I told you her name, you wouldn't know her. And she is a buffoon even in her own party. Take that insult to your... Besides, I had considerable, as suggested, I had considerable admiration from long-time bureaucrats as well as leadership in the House, because I was willing to advocate for those who had no defender. For example, juries. Yeah, with all due respect to Ken Driggs and his attorney and Bill Morrison, their attorney profession, they have the Trial Lawyers Association. And the courts and the judges have their court lobbyists on the Hill every year at six-figure incomes. There's all kinds of advocacy in the legal system all the way down to the American public who has no advocate at all, I ran a bill to increase the juror reimbursement, and it passed. Bill Deinhardt, who was the fiscal analyst at the time, said, Zolman, there is no advocacy for juror membership, and you're there. What will you do next? Well, he gave me the theme of my political life. I then surveyed the Utah landscape, and this is the equation I wanted to know. If my own freedom is to be considered secure, who then, living within these borders, would be the weakest political link in the state? I didn't have to look very far. However, understand, I am a convert LDS person from Montana. I have no polygamous background. I have a very successful 32-year monogamous, with all things Sydney said about failing monogamism. I and she's right, I'm not disagreeing with her, but mine happens to be a very happy, successful, 9 children later, we still are happy. I have 29 years on the same job and 24 years in the same address. I'm not an unstable kind of person. I don't take causes because I need something to do. I don't like change. But freedom is a different thing. Abraham Lincoln said, freedom isn't just for the free, it's also for the slave. And then I began to do my own homework on that subculture crumpled beside the road in Utah. I went to Colorado City, picked of all days to come. Honest, I am a complete neophyte. I arrived July 26th on a Sunday while I was a member of the House and knocked on the FLDS church door wanting to go to their church meeting. Well, that's the very day they celebrate Short Creek Raid. They were horrified of me. And they ushered me out. They wouldn't even let me get anywhere near that. And old Sam Barlow said, boy, you picked a bad day to come. And I appreciate what he said after he took me the next day in his car, and they showed me where they picked him up in the schoolyard, and they bussed him off. And then I picked up the book, Kidnapped from This Land, and I read my history after I tried to repeat history. And they thought I was sent to stir them up again. And I understand. They celebrate that day as often as we celebrate the 24th of July up here on the Wasatch Front. Well, I guess they do it on the Wasatch back, too. But notwithstanding, the whole idea that there was freedoms limited in this subculture, to me, offended the very purpose for which I was elected to serve. If there's anybody who does not have the same freedom I do, then my freedom is in jeopardy. So with no more than feeling, I began to ask these questions of legislators. Why do we have a law on the books, I said, but you don't enforce it? And I suggested to them, having served on the Criminal Courts and Corrections Committee, that if you enforce the law, I'll vote for the bill that says lock all of the suckers up. I said, if you've got 30,000, build the light-duty prisons and let's put them all in there, and we can say we enforce the law and we're not a bunch of hypocrites. But however, if you're not inclined to prosecute these people, then why is the law there? Especially the thing that put the law in there in the first place, the Edmund Tucker Act, and can you correct me if I'm wrong, was repealed in 1972 from the federal government because Western Samoa was to become a territory. So the very the judicial prejudice that brought that Article 3, Section 1, or Section 1, Article 3, whichever it is, these legal terms are easily convoluted and conjugated in my book. These things were removed, and Utah is the only state left with that prohibition. We were the only state to have it up to state 45, 46, 47, 48 had it in their boilerplate. They immediately repealed the section because it didn't apply. Utah still is the only state in the union, then out of 50, that has this prohibition against polygamy. So my suggestion to my fellow legislators, not only do we have a law we're not going to enforce, we have 30,000 people that are disenfranchised, and when are we going to start to make peace with them? Well, they weren't listening. So I continued my little odyssey. I continued my little, and I got the reporter. I went to Applebee's, and I will never forget this day. I said, Dan, do you know what I think we ought to do as a state? I think we ought to apologize to the polygamists for how badly we've treated them. And the roof on that was the beginning of the end of my political career. From that day to this, I've had legislators who say, why did you waste your political capital on such a cuckamamie idea as that? And I said, freedom to me is not cuckamamie, and I never will be a polygamist, but I always want to be free. And we went after it. And I was abused by the left and right, and I made my relatives uncomfortable, and I made my neighbors wonder, what is he going to do next? And then always, and people are saying, what is he trying to do? And the people that knew me best said, he really is just standing for freedom. He is not auguring for another wife. Because Sheila said, he gets another wife, he's still a monogamist because I'm gone. Those of you who know Sheila, no, that's a direct quote. There was no reason for my being so misunderstood by the press, except that I touched that nerve of prejudice, which I recognized in the South when I went down there on a mission, and I saw in the Phillips 66, men on the toilet, women, toilet, colored. And I thought, man, it took so long to get the 1964 Civil Rights Act to make that change. What is it going to take in Utah to make the change? And I was willing to step up and make the statement, and now others will have to step in my place if my opponents have anything to say about that. Anyway, I want to complete and conclude my thoughts with what helped me define my belief in your polygamous rights. And it's the very great-grandmother of Governor Mike Leavitt and the very JUAB prosecutor. When Mary Luella Abbott Leavitt wrote in her journal, which journal I had, and I quoted, she is writing at the end of her life, and she says this, I hope not one of the children will ever speak lightly of it or say they do not believe in the principle because I feel it is one of God's greatest commandments given to his people. It took courage, faith, prayer, determination, and the help of the Lord to do this with much more trust in the Lord. That was done before I even ran for mayor. And now the echo of this has an interesting symmetry for me. I'm now one who is pleased to let others step up. I'd like to give another postscript. I'm a little over, but I want to. When I met with Ogden and Ann the first time, full of enthusiasm that something could be done, one of my political motivations was the constant refrain I was hearing that Utah has a dirty little secret. And when the Olympics comes, our dirty little secret will shame us. And I thought, what a strange way to look at that. And so in an effort to avoid that shame or heal from it or at least divert it, I then met with Ogden and Ann and Mary and Gary, and we just began discussions not knowing that it would end up being that wonderful book, Voices of Harmony, which removed the shame, which was really just ignorance. And not once did I hear, prior to the Olympics, nor anything since, a journalist refer to Utah's dirty little secret. That is the exclamation point of my political career. I removed a small ounce of shame from Utah's escutcheon. Thank you very much.
Well, you know that old maxim, when the wicked rule, the people mourn? Ever since Dave's been out, I've been mourning quite a lot. So I wish he was still a state legislator. Now we're going to open the time for questions and answers. Let's just go right ahead. I'll try and do it in an orderly fashion. If you'd like, you can address your question to a specific panel member or just open it up to the panel as a whole, and we'll start right here.
Linda, thank you very much for sharing your experience, and it was a really lovely to hear from you, but I do have
You mentioned that you really respected the Greens in one respect because they showed an alternate to the evil divorce that we find so prevalent in monogamy. I was wondering if you could tell me how many women Tom Green has married in his life.
I don't know the family that well.
Does anyone on the panel know? If you don't, I do. 10? And how many women is he married to now?
5.
So, do you know how many
women... The 50% divorce rate.
Yeah.
In polygamy.
So what about...
I would say the divorce rate within polygamy is probably about the same as the divorce rate in monogamy, in a sense.
So that's really not a very valid argument.
It is a valid argument in the sense that polygamy does offer women the opportunity to live in a multiple relationship if they so choose. Whereas right now, if there are two women that want to share the same husband, they are not legally allowed to do so. And so one is left unmarried and single, and the other is left with a husband. That's hardly fair to both women, especially if there's a choice as a consenting adult to choose that
solid relationship. I was speaking about divorce. So I wasn't really interested.
That's what I'm saying. What it can do is it can alleviate a lot of divorce problems. The other thing it can do is create a situation where
women
just working for a marriage. Right. It's no different in a sense because you're all working for a marriage.
Thank you. Back here. Oh, sure. Come on up. Use the mic. Feel free. And maybe that's... Would everybody like the party asking the question to approach the mic? Let's do that then. All right. Let's do that. And the respondent as well?
Is it not? No, it's working. It's working. My question is directed to those who are actually in plural marriages. As I've listened to you speak, I've been intrigued by the similarity between the rhetorical strategies that have been used to defend plural marriage and those that are being used to defend same-sex relationships. You know, in both cases, you have a group where the relationship is criminalized, there's a sense of secrecy surrounding it, there's a kind of coming out, if you will, as polygamists. And I'm wondering, as the gay rights movement has evolved, one of its earliest priorities was decriminalizing same-sex relationships, trying to get sodomy laws repealed. And then the movement was able to move on to another goal, which was to have relationships not only decriminalized, but also given formal recognition, hence the push for same-sex marriage. I'm wondering, as polygamists become more politically organized, obviously the primary goal is to have polygamy decriminalized. Is there a long-range goal towards trying to get polygamous marriage is actually formally recognized by the state? Is that a goal that the polygamous community isn't even in a position at this point to contemplate? I guess I'm wondering how much of a political foresight is there? Yeah.
I kind of real quick shed the light. I think at this point...
If you can, sure.
My voice is so loud. No one tells me to go to a microphone. I think at this point, the general polygamous community at large would say that legalization is not on their horizon. This is a principle that we live by faith. We do not want our faith and our religious beliefs government-controlled and government-overseen. These are faith-promoted relationships in the general population of the polygamists, I think, right now.
I realize there are a lot of similarities between the homosexuals and the polygamists. The only similarity I would like to recognize is the fact that our civil rights issues remain the same. On a political level, we are entitled to equal rights. Religiously is another matter, and I'm not going to go into that, but that's where we draw the line.
I'd like to address this to Mr. Whalen. Mr. Zolman got rid of the dirty little secret attitude toward polygamy as far as the state goes, but within the church, I think it's a dirty little secret because while it's in the basic doctrine of the church is expounded, and I have not read your book, but I presume you're going back into the last century, not the last, the previous century. The doctrine has never been renounced, but it's never talked about. I mean, it was never mentioned in general conference for decades and so on, even though it was a bedrock doctrine at one time. Did you get any encouragement or discouragement from official church channels in terms of
putting this book out, and on your local level, state, bishop, ward level, and things like that? What kind of responses it had? That's my... Because you're sort of... I would say that that's a dirty little secret no one's wanted to talk about for a long time.
We have not heard from General Church Headquarters. We have heard from our local leaders who have expressed a great concern that we're practicing polygamy, promoting it. And I certainly have expressed to them that, you know, where we stand is right in the book. If you want to know where that is, read the book. And I would say that to anybody. As far as it being a dirty little secret, it is, I think, considered that by a lot of members, as well as the leadership. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to bring it out. But there is another whole side to that that we have seen. There are a lot of people, as I mentioned earlier, that have a great interest in that. And there are leaders that have a great interest in it. And we have experienced that in book signings, other areas where people will come up and say, thank you so much for finally bringing this out. You know, we're taking Grandma out of the closet now and talking about her.
What does your billboard say?
The billboard says more than one, a sacred pioneer heritage, excuse me, plural marriage, a sacred pioneer heritage. And then that, again, is to promote the idea that it is something sacred in our heritage, more to change the idea of plural marriage rather than, or the perception of it rather than to advertise the book.
It has pictures of Joseph Smith, Brigham Young.
Yes, it does have pictures of a lot of Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and the other leaders, and some women that are great advocates for plural marriage.
I have a practical question, getting away from the philosophies of plural marriage. There seems to be a pattern in the public's eyes, especially with violations of problems with practice of polygamy and child rearing and so forth, that involves a dependency on public support to sustain the lifestyle. And this was certainly demonstrated in the Tom Green instance, where certain public monies, welfare type of support, for example, is being utilized to sustain the lifestyle. So my question is, as we bring polygamy out of the closet in this era, how do you propose dealing with the public's perception that there is a excessive dependency and demand on public support for the lifestyle?
From the DCFS, it lists the food stamp recipients and the aid to family with dependent children. So it's a money allotments and an AFDC. The problem you're discussing and addressing, I think, is not conducive or singularly a polygamous problem. Because statistics, Washington County, these are listed by counties, is the Short Creek, Colorado City, the highest probably concentration of polygamous families in the state, in that county. Okay, Washington County, as of 1996, and I could not get this from the AFDC, but as of 1996, per 1,000 had 19.55 users of AFDC. Salt Lake County had 19.32. And where is Utah County? Utah County, 12.34 per 1,000. This is the state statistics. If you split that and you have the food stamp recipients, Washington County, again, the highest population of polygamists in the state, 65.96 have a food stamp usage out of 1,000. Salt Lake County, 48.82. San Pete County, I love that county, 81.47. San Pete County, I will guarantee you, is so mainstream, LDS, monogamous, and they have 81.47, and Washington County has 65.96. Okay? There is not an overriding problem with abuse of polygamous families and on the state. It's a misnomer, big time.
to support what she's saying, in our when we send out the information to get to compile on our book, we sent out a questionnaire, and one of the questions had to do with financial help. And the results were, out of the 100 women that responded, that 77% had never used any kind of financial aid. And then it gives, like, two women used food stamps, and then, and some of the women, believe it or not, were had used it years and years ago when their husbands were in prison for plural marriage. So they had to go on food stamps. So really, that's one of the stereotypes that our book is trying to disprove.
I'm not terrible. Is this any good?
Yeah.
Oh. I'm not terribly interested in financial things or political things, though I am a political activist. What I am interested in is the expression of faith that I've heard here today. It has changed my mind considerably about plural marriage. We're very prejudiced because we don't want our husbands to have anybody else. We monogamous. But I have seen a kind of faith here that I didn't know existed. And I have great respect for that kind of faith. As far as the mainstream Mormon church is concerned, our present prophet, Hinckley, says, we have nothing to do with polygamy. That is not quite true. We have everything to do with polygamy. We marry people every day in our temples for eternity. So we do have something to do with it. It's one of our ideal ideas. And while most of us now couldn't live it, I couldn't and wouldn't. I'd be one of those who'd be out of there, and then he'd be a monogamous. But because I've had him 58 years, and I kind of like him. But I really think that we mainstreamers still have a lot more to do with polygamy than we're admitting.
I'm going to shake a little bit. My English is not that perfect, but I felt very strong to say what I was thinking when all of them talk. And I think I see a problem, and I don't want to offend anybody. But since I came here 2.5 years ago, I have found problem that people said America, United States is not America. America is the whole continent. United States is one of the countries of America. Other problem, people reject people living polygamy. Other problem I have found, I have a friend who lives in Springville, and she's inactive, and people don't talk to her. Her neighborhood don't talk to her. And I was shocked, because in my country, the most people are Catholics, and we don't do that to people. And I have found that people, many people reject blacks, many people reject Spanish, or many people reject poor people or crippled people. And I feel really sad. I am not saying I am perfect, but I am trying to love everybody. And sometimes people, when see me with my husband, I am a little bit younger than him. And people sometimes look at us like, what is she doing with that man? And he's just wonderful, but I think we criticize too much. We judge people too much. And I think we have to have love. And that's the problem that everybody has. We don't have enough love. And if we have love, we will not do anything to these people or to anybody else. Thanks.
I'm curious to know if the state's financial expenditures on the Green family have risen lately. But anyway, my question is this. Maybe this is kind of a legal question, but I know about the Reynolds thing, and that the state kind of hopes that the Reynolds thing will stick around so that they can hold that over our heads and make us feel bad, because supposedly the Reynolds decision makes it to where you can actually say that polygamy is not in the best interest. It's harmful to the state. It's harmful to the state's welfare. But if you have someone like Bill Clinton who's married, and then he has sexual activity with this other woman, and he defines her as a mistress, and then you have a guy in Utah who's married, and then he has sexual activity with an additional woman, and he uses the word wife, or plural, or polygamy, Is it not a violation of the First Amendment and the question of free speech where one man goes to prison for using the word wife and the other man doesn't for saying mistress or girlfriend?
I have a couple of questions, one particularly for Mr. Zolman. I was very moved by your discussion. When you began to defend the polygamists in the state, what kind of subtle, indirect or not so indirect pressures did you receive from whatever sources? I'd be very curious to know. And actually, did you ever receive any physical threats or any implied physical threats?
As a matter of fact, my family has remained remarkably insulated from this. None of my children have been insulted or in any way. That's a very interesting question. Part of that is because I have real obnoxious kids. And if you dare to insult them, they'd punch you in the nose. So that's part of it. They're very confident kids. And so they have not been threatened. I have not received insulting phone calls or threatened letters. I have been... my local church leaders have opposed my election, and they have run against me while sitting in their various church offices. So there has been a mixture of church and state there, which is fine. It's their perfect political right to do that. But otherwise, I have remained remarkably whole in the brickbats that could have been thrown. So the answer to your question is, the reason we love America is that you can do these things and still have your life.
Second question for any in the panel is, you know, a statement has been made, and I'm not sure where and who, when it was made, but it was repeated again recently, and that is an attempt to disenfranchise polygamists by saying they are not members of the church, therefore they're not Mormons. And I wonder if any of you have heard that comment or that statement, and what sort of implications that's had as you've thought about it.
Well, I can't speak for the whole fundamentalist community, but I certainly consider myself a Mormon. I believe in Joseph Smith. I believe in the teachings that he taught. I believe in the Book of Mormon. I consider myself very much a Mormon. I remember hearing Michael Quinn, who is maybe on a little bit different perspective, saying even though he's been cut off the church, he still considers himself a Mormon. Now, whether or not the presidency of the church wants to consider us Mormons, that's their own choice. But I think I speak for all the fundamentalists I know. We definitely consider ourselves to be Mormon.
Oh, let me just take 1 second and elaborate on that, because I think what Ann was talking about in particular was that we consider, and I can say that, and if you guys disagree, go right ahead, because some of you may disagree, consider ourselves to be Joseph Smith Mormons, that he restored the gospel in its entirety, and that it's been diluted, and that we don't like the dilution, and we want the fountainhead. Exactly what was restored, that's what we believe in. Okay?
I have two questions, and these follow up on previous questions. The first one deals with gay and lesbians. I would be interested if, do you generally support the same type of rights for gay and lesbians?
I absolutely do that. I think that it is every individual's right to live according to their lifestyle choices, and we have absolutely no rights to criminalize.
I feel that very intensely, what you just said, because when I was shown the back door in the house for my advocacy for polygamy, plural marriage society, the only lesbian in the legislature was shown the back row in the Democratic Party, which means leadership. So I feel that very keenly, what you said. And my view of that is, as I talk to various polygamists, until they learn to do charity and do public relations like the gay and lesbians, they will always be that subculture, and lack the popularity that I think the gay and the gay pride community has. I think your parade, I think the, and I'm not talking about you, nothing personal here, but in case you bring it up, I'll refer, your effect on public sentiment is positive because of the good things that you've done, and the polygamists need to do the same thing.
My second question goes back to the issue of public aid, and I believe that was first reported in the Salt Lake Tribune, and what they were doing is looking at rates, and correct me if I'm wrong, rates of public aid in Colorado City, which they found to be quite high. Was that? I mean, maybe I'm a misunderstanding, or
I spoke with the reporter who tried to explain how those statistics were brought forth and how they did that. He said they did something of a mailing, that they mailed out questionnaires to everyone in Colorado City, and in Colorado City the percentage was higher than in other cities. And I said, well, and I showed him the statistics I was just speaking of, and I said, how does that mesh with this that the state itself has publicized? He goes, well, it doesn't.
One other point I want to make on that. Colorado City being in Arizona, all of the Indian tribes have higher requirements than the polygamous community. So if you compare Arizona to Arizona, it's not unusual. That was comparing apples to oranges there.
I'd like to ask Anne, she mentioned two or three times in her presentation that an outside source had encouraged them to write the book. I just wondered what the outside source was.
From the Lord. But
that's what I thought.
Get up there and say, if the Lord inspired us to do that, people might find that offensive because they don't believe in plural marriage. We very strongly have our testimony regarding that, but it may not set well with the audience.
I have a question and a comment. The question, if you feel comfortable, I'd like to elaborate on this information about the electronic bugging, if you feel comfortable. My question...